dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary with the first show of 2009. Over the past few weeks, I've been airing material from a teach-in called Confronting the Triple Crisis, Climate Change, Peak Oil, and Resource Depletion. I'm going to play you more from that teach-in this week, as well as resume reading from the book Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal, as we start a new chapter. A theme that will emerge from the teach-in speakers is the role of the economic system in both bringing about the crises and impeding solutions to it. The economic and political institutions of modern industrial societies are built upon a hierarchy of disrespect towards humans and non-humans alike. That, in turn, is based on what I think is a sadomasochistic worldview, one that glorifies dominance on the one hand and promises salvation through submission on the other. The developed industrial countries have acquired their living standards by depriving people in the so-called third world of their ability to live. Riches are extracted from their lands, but most of the people and ecosystems of these places are devastated. Last week, we heard of the situation of the people in Appalachia whose homeland is being destroyed by coal extraction. This is what has been done all over the world in the service of what one of our speakers from Latin America this week calls the God of Economic Growth. Unless we collectively relinquish a worldview based on status and dominance and adopt one based on balance, on proportionality, on equity, on respect, I don't see how we can ever do what we need to do to coexist sustainably with life on this planet. In an interview I did with Derek Jensen a few months ago, he mentioned that the songbird population had crashed by 80%, yet this was not considered a crisis. Though, if the GDP had crashed by that much, it would certainly be considered an emergency. Our society is in thrall to abstractions, out of touch with reality. Instead of just stopping the practices that are destroying life on Earth, yes, just stopping, and calculating how to rearrange things so each has what they need, the powers that be are so subservient to the monster they have created that they propose insane non-solutions to preserve it. One of those non-solutions that we're going to hear discussed in policy circles in the coming year, as well as on the program this week, is carbon trading, buying the so-called right to pollute. The first speaker I'm going to play for you this week will address what Europeans have learned from the carbon trading experience.
Hill comes from Germany. She's from a group called FERN, F-E-R-N, which stands for Forests and the European Union. European Union Resource Network, and you can tell from that obviously they work a great deal on forests and with forests, people's rights and policies and practices in the European Union. Jutta has herself been trained and in terms of forest ecology issues. She's been a climate campaigner for FERN since the year 2000, and she also participated very much in contributing to the Durban Group's critique on carbon trading. She's become a leading voice in the failings of carbon offset schemes, and I think has a lot to contribute to these false solutions and understanding of the false solutions that are being propagated along these kind of lines. So will you welcome, please, Jutta Gill.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the kind introduction, and also thank you for the great context that you've set for this talk now and for exploring with you why carbon trading is a false solution to the climate crisis. I should say that the analysis that I'll present about why it is that carbon trading won't get us out of the climate crisis is an analysis that no one person could possibly ever pull together. And it has been pulled together by a large group of people who came together in 2004 in Durban in South Africa. And out of that meeting grew the Durban Group for Climate Justice. And I owe it to my colleagues in that group to acknowledge their large, large contribution to the analysis that I'll be presenting here. So please make sure that, it's not me. As I said, it will never be one single person who will be able to pull apart what is not told about carbon trading. Before I go into the details, I want to sort of start with two other sort of notes of caution, maybe, or one. There's never been a topic I've worked on that has been so laced with jargon than the debate about carbon trading. And I believe that that is not without intention, because the more jargon you introduce into a debate, the harder it is for the public and for all of us to see through the falsehood that's hidden behind that jargon. And that's why I'm really particularly glad to be here and compare with you some notes, because about 10 years ago, we were told in Europe that pollution trading had a long and good history in the US, and that it was doing fine with reducing pollution in the area of nitrous oxides and lead. So it was going to be fine to just expand that idea to carbon trading. And I find it quite interesting that 10 years down the road, I hear from colleagues in the US that now the European emissions trading scheme, which has pioneered or is said to have pioneered carbon trading, is the model to look to because it's working well. Well, I hope I can share with you in the next 10, 15 minutes or so a little bit of an impression that the European emissions trading scheme is not working well. It is certainly not working well if the objective was to address climate change. So why is it that we take issue with carbon trading, often considered the only game in town? And what is it that we don't like about putting a price on carbon? The issue is that we believe carbon trading is not capable of triggering the revolution in energy infrastructure that is needed. And I'll get back to that in a little bit. The simple fact is that most of the fossil fuels that today are still underground will have to stay underground. Just look at the top number. With that volume, there is already too much in the atmosphere. But if you compare that with how much coal there still is there to dig up, and we've heard about the consequences on a local level of that already before, there is just no simple way, no single way, and no way that there is an instrument like carbon trading that could keep us safe if it allows the continuation of digging up oil and coal. They're simply, sheerly looking at the numbers, there is no way. So it's very clear that the simple challenge, and it's not a simple challenge in many ways, but the clear challenge is to move away from our addiction to fossil fuels. I want to take you a little bit now to the European experience with carbon trading, and maybe in two sentences, what is carbon trading? Carbon trading is meant to be an instrument that puts a price on carbon. If you have two companies, each of them is given a certain amount of permits, say 100 units. So together they can emit 200 units of carbon dioxide into the air. Carbon trading is based on the rationale that it doesn't matter if the first company or the first factory uses up 150 of those units and the other 150. As long as it's just 200, carbon trading will help to find the cheapest way to stick within that limit. But there is a few very questionable assumptions in that. Carbon trading says it doesn't matter where you reduce emissions. The reality of people around coal factories, the reality of people around oil refineries, tells us very clearly that it does matter where we reduce emissions. Because it's not only carbon dioxide that matters, it's also the other social and environmental impacts that come with oil exploration, with coal extraction. But carbon trading doesn't acknowledge those. So it simply says, if we have to stay within a certain limit, just give the companies the freedom to find the cheapest way to stay inside that limit. What carbon trading also has shown is that because this is an entirely artificial market, set up not by the need to buy and sell, but set up by the need of politicians to find a way out of the difficult choices that they have to lead us into. But that reality that carbon trading is built upon an artificial market means that companies will exploit to as far as possible and as far as they can that artificiality. When we look at the first round of emissions trading in Europe, where the largest companies, the largest emitters, the oil refineries, the power producers, the steel companies, the pharmaceutical industries, those were the big industries that were included in this emissions trading scheme. When we look at the results from that first round of emissions trading, we see who the winners are. We see that the European emissions trading scheme and any other scheme that will be introduced along the same lines has resulted in the quasi-privatization of the atmosphere. It has transferred the right with a very specific monetary value of emissions onto the balance sheets of some of the most powerful companies. Some of the companies that are in the first place responsible for the carbon crisis. The funny thing about these permits in the European emissions trading scheme is that they've been given out for free to the companies. So the government said, we have to reduce emissions, but we have to win big industry to join in. So we don't ask them to pay the permits to emit greenhouse gases. We give them to them for free. And we don't do that in a particularly transparent process. We negotiate with them. And if you look at the next slide and then come back to this one again, you see who won. Some of the largest oil companies, the energy utilities, in this case in the UK, made record windfall profits from carbon trading. And as you will see later on in the presentation, emissions went up nonetheless. And if we can go back to the previous slide for a moment. Because there is one other very disturbing aspect about carbon trading that's generally not being discussed. When you look at that list, you see that about 17 to 34% of the amount that the atmosphere can deal with in terms of greenhouse gas emissions has just been given for free to European industries. If 100% is the maximum, 17 to 34% certainly is not a fair share for a very small minority of high polluting industries in Europe. So there's a justice of inequality here that's being perpetuated. And again, when you look at the record windfall profits that those companies can make, I believe it becomes very clear why there was not all that much resistance, after all, amongst some of the largest industries in Europe to introduce emissions trading. If we skip over the next one, I just want to share in the next three slides some of the conclusions from people who I think can't necessarily be said to be particularly environmentally inclined. They have looked at emissions trading in the European Union, mostly from a purely economic point of view. And what they have found is that emissions trading is not going to trigger the kind of long-term investments in a totally different energy infrastructure that we need if we are to address global warming, if we are to move into and beyond the triple crisis. Carbon trading puts a price on carbon, but that price will fluctuate hugely. We have seen in the first period of emissions trading in Europe, the price go between 30 euros a ton to nearly being worthless. Well, some of that had to do with the fact that governments gave out more permits than industry needed, so there wasn't much of a reduction happening, and of course the price as a result collapsed as well. But it also shows that whilst carbon trading puts, or emissions trading puts, a price on the carbon, what industry is asking for to make those long-term investments into an entirely different way of producing and using energy is not going to be provided by carbon trading, because the price will fluctuate. And you're not going to be convinced to make a big investment if you still have the hope that somewhere down the line that price of carbon will stay low enough for you to stay with your old, outdated coal or oil-based technology. So there's an inherent problem in that system. It's not going to give us the right trigger, or us. It's not going to give industry the right trigger to now make the big investments that will lock us into a different energy infrastructure. And that is important, because there is no time to lose. A lot of the energy infrastructure in the industrialized countries, in the OECD countries, will be replaced in the next 10 to 15 years. That's where we decide what our energy sources will be for the next 50 years to come. So the choices are now, and therefore instruments are needed now to give the right message. Carbon trading is giving the wrong message. Just gamble that you can buy up those permits on the market when they're cheap. And if we move on to another sort of myth that I want to dispel about the European emissions trading scheme. It's often referred to as a cap and trade scheme. It puts a cap on the overall allowable emissions in the European Union, and within that cap, companies can trade. The trouble is that in reality, that cap has a huge hole. And that hole allows extra permits to flow into the European emissions trading scheme. Where do those permits come from? They come from offset projects. What are offset projects? They're the second type of trading that's often included or subsumed in the term carbon trading. There is this idea of you cap the overall emissions, and then companies or individuals are allowed to trade. Cap and trade, or emissions trading. There is a second part to how you can trade carbon, and that is called project-based offsets. Many of you may have come across them, because they've also become very popular for individuals who feel that, you know, you have to offset or carbon neutralize or climate neutralize your flight, your wedding, the CD release, the tour with the CD release, the funeral I've recently seen, the Formula One race. All can be carbon neutralized, all can be offset. But those kinds of offset projects also inflate that cap. They make that cap bigger. They've torn a hole into it. Why is that a problem? Well, first of all, because it allows European companies to buy their way out of changes domestically, because we just pay somebody else somewhere else to make an emissions reductions and claim that it's just as good as ours. But maybe more importantly, those offsets are also fundamentally a problem, Because nobody can really verify that that extra emission reduction that I have bought to neutralize my flight really is an extra emission reduction. The idea is, and we run through the next five in a sequence, that we can keep on using up oil and gas and coal as long as somebody else plants some tree somewhere else, builds some windmill somewhere else, and we'll be fine. You know, it'll be neutral. I've burned some more fossil fuels, but somewhere else, somebody else has planted some trees that wouldn't have been planted otherwise. Somebody else has planted some windmills that wouldn't have gone up otherwise. The trouble is that really knowing whether those extra emissions cuts or reductions from that windmill are truly extra, truly over and above what would have happened anyways, is anybody's guess. Because it would require looking into the future. It would require understanding what would have happened if that offset project hadn't come about. Because if my windmill would have been built anyways 5 years down the road, I'm not saving extra. I'm not neutralizing. And that is the big problem with carbon offset projects. They assuage our guilt. They make us believe that we are addressing climate change. But in reality, they're built on a premise that we cannot verify. And if you just run through the remaining slides, and I'll keep an eye on them and come to them. The other problem with offsets is that not only do we never know whether they really produce extra emission reductions, they've also in many cases done harm to local communities. And you could easily imagine a situation where the coal companies in the Appalachian Mountains say, it's fine to take off another top of the mountain because we have paid a community in India to build up some windmills that they wouldn't have built up otherwise, and they would have burned coal in our stead otherwise. So it's fine. We're carbon neutral. So don't complain about the ongoing exploration in the Appalachian Mountains because it's climate neutral. And with that, I want to close and say there is no shortcut out of the climate crisis. And the beginning of that is that we acknowledge the fundamental change that's required, the fundamental change in energy infrastructure, the fundamental change in the way we use and produce energy. And carbon trading is a false solution to that because it will not give us the triggers and not give industry the triggers to move beyond energy infrastructures that rely fundamentally on oil and gas and coal. And with that, I would like to leave it here and hope that we can continue the discussion later on as well. Thank you.
That was Jutta Kill of Germany.
Sarah Lorraine is going to give you what's happening in her part of the world. Sarah is the co-founder of the Chilean National Political Party. She coordinates the Chilean Ecological Action Network. She founded the Chilean Office of Greenpeace International. And she was also a leading independent candidate in the 1999 Chilean presidential election. Now, Sarah is also an IFG board member and will talk to you about what the crisis is in Chile. Sarah.
Thank you very much. I will try to present with some figures and analysis the situation of Latin America and what it means, the triple crisis for Latin America. The first one is SWATER, territory and ecosystem degradation and lost, that it's very well presented yesterday and also in the panel on coal, mainly this morning. The second aspect is energy intensity and CO2 emissions increased to feed the exports activities from Latin America to the rest of the world. And the third level, or the third problem of the triple crisis in Latin America means climate vulnerability, that is in addition to the vulnerability of water scarcity or territory erosion. And this means also a second scale in the case of biofuels, crops, for that compete with food production, more tensions between companies and government and local communities, more tension between the business communities, and of course in terms of natural disasters and in terms of political problems. This means economic collapse and also probably more militarization of political regimes in the future, because more or less we know what these are the consequences of these trends. In terms of the first one, the water, territory, and ecosystem degradation, because of the current globalization and the economic ideology of economic growth as the goal of the economy and the goal for development, you need to recognize that the Latin American territory and the Latin American ecosystems are materials for the global economy. So you have in the region in the last years, and with the China economic development, you have an intensification of natural resource exports to the industrial companies and to China to feed the global consumer class. Then you have, of course, loss of natural patrimony, land and natural resources, no job creation, I will present some figures on this, privatization and concentration of land and natural resource ownership is part of the same process. It's not only natural resource exploitation. It's at the same time concentration and privatization of land and natural resources is part of the same phenomenon. And, of course, not income distribution is the an escalate in the inequity social system. You have that mainly it's this aspect, this water, territory, and ecosystem degradation, is a physical aspect of the implementation of the model that have economic growth as God. And that means that the global economic instrument, including, of course, the free trade agreements, turn nature into a commodity. And, of course, commodification of nature turn access to natural resources an issue of money. So, nature access for rich and corporations. When nature began to be traded under the logic of individual or corporate property rights, you have commodification and privatization. And privatization of natural resources in the global economy means concentration, monopolization of nature. All territories are legally open for corporations that can play in the scale of the global economy. So today, because of these economic instruments and political negotiations, we have legal systems that consolidate that this situation continue and continue forever. If you see what are the figures of goods exports in Latin American region between 1990 and the year 2006, you will see a lot of export in the first part, but you see a huge increase from 93 to now. And there you can see that mainly the more dynamic exports is from Venezuela, Chile, Peru, Ecuador, Colombia, Bolivia. And the median average in Latin America is more or less 12.3 of growth annually. But if you go, in addition to that, If you go and see what is the Latin American region, it's exporting to China. So what are the part of the natural resource that the China economy use now that came from Latin America? This table presents the total China imports from Latin America and the rest of the world. You will see that in terms of fish meal, you have 81% that comes from Latin America to China. In terms of grapes, it's 60%. In terms of soya, also 60%. In terms of sugar, 49%. So China economy depends from heavily from natural resources from Latin America. And if you go and see the territories that provide these resources, and you don't see the abstraction of countries, but territories and ecosystems, and you go for the first product, where the Latin America provide 81% of all the fish meal China use, you will have Peru and Chile providing this fish meal. This is all the Pacific coast. This is all the territory in the coastal zones. This means all the economic waters of the two countries. So the impacts are so concentrated in the lands and in the ecosystems. So it's not figures and countries and as abstract things. In terms of soya, you can imagine what means that Argentina and Brazil feed China economy with 60% of all the soya that China import to the country. What this means in terms of water needs, what it means in terms of soil needs, fertilizer, the impact of communities. The same in the case of grapes from Chile, one country. It's providing and feeding China in this. So it's really a thing of a scale that can show you that there is no only abstract thing that is figures and countries, but it's ecosystems, territories, and some buying products and some expoliate territories. What it means in terms of nature and livelihood rights? When you commodify and what is the ideology of the economy that is moving this system, you have that, of course, commodification and privatization. You have market competitiveness goal displace local communities from their territories and expropriate their access to natural resources and ecosystems. Yesterday, the panel go deeply on this problem. Then you have commodification exposing nature to corporate appetite and the sucking of global market towards the planet consumer class. And then you have commodification and expropriation of nature as a way that destroy cultural and spiritual relations between human beings and living systems of nature and extinguish knowledge and cultures. So in the same way what's happened in the physical level, it's happening the erosion of culture and the erosion of the knowledge of the different people about themselves and about the territories they live in. More investment and in general investment is the way to do this. Investment is not more jobs. In the table you see, especially in case of mining and energy, energy, of course, to link with mining and link with industrial agriculture and need with cellulose, it's exactly the two sectors that create less jobs in terms of investment intensity. So the systems don't create a job that is one of the huge promise of the system. More GDP and more growth also is not development. You have here Chile, Colombia, and Brazil, members of the top 10 worst income distribution countries. You have these three countries with Namibia, Lesotho, Botswana, Sierra Leone, República Centroafricana, Swaziland, and South Africa in the group of the country with worst income distribution. The second element of the triple crisis in Latin America is energy intensity and CO2 emissions increase. To feed export activities, it's completely linked with the first aspect of the crisis. This means for the region a second assault to ecosystems and territories. This means the killing of rivers for dams in all the countries, now in Patagonia also. This means oil exploration in several countries, also in the Amazonas. And of course, this can be massive crops for biofuels in the near future. This is a second escalation of the same thing that's happened with natural resources. Energy, it's for business and for export activities. It's not for people. There are no commercial energy in rural areas in the majority of Latin America. And also you have, as part of the same process, the privatization and transnationalization of energy sources and companies. So you need, and why this privatization and transnationalization is because for this export economy, you need energy intensity, and energy intensity needs investment intensity. So it's part of the same process. And, of course, also the energy sector don't create significant jobs. Oil and coal it's increasing the region in the last 7 years. This is figures of ECLAC in Latin America. The same happened with CO2 emissions from the year 1990 to the year 2004. You will have that the country that with more increase of emission is Vietnam, Taiwan, Thailand, Bangladesh, Kuwait, Malaysia, Singapore, and China. In the case of Latin America, you have Chile with 97% of increase of CO2 emissions from the year 1990 to now. You have that Chile grow 4 times the CO2 in respect to the amount of the world, and Central and South America double the world median average of CO2 emissions. This is not developed for people. This is because the energy intensity for the export economy. Also, you will see now several Latin American countries in the same level of countries that have compromises in the Kyoto Protocol system. You have Argentina in the same level of emission of Lithuania, Polonia, and Croatia, and these countries have obligations under the Kyoto Protocol. You have also Chile, Brazil. Brazil is the only exception because it's mainly deforestation. But you have Colombia, Peru, that the emissions is linked with the export sectors. And the last part of the triple crisis in Latin America is climate vulnerability. This climate vulnerability increases economic and political vulnerability. Why? Because water scarcity for agriculture, industries, and energy, and no reserve of water because of glacier reduction. Latin America, as you know, mainly South America, is dependent on the glaciers' water for the rivers and agriculture. It means loss of territory, land, and coastal ecosystem, and more natural disasters. This is more vulnerability. Also, it means a possibility of a third assault to ecosystems linked with crop for biofuels, that will pressure over food production, land and water ownership concentration, part of the same phenomena of crops for biofuels. You are looking now in Latin America and in the context of global warming with the more scarcity of resources. You will see more tension between business and communities, and also internally between economic sectors that fight for resources competition in mining. Mining and agriculture now is fighting for water. In the future, we will see more serious confrontation on this. You also will see more migration, environmental refugees, and of course, natural resource regional conflicts for water, for energy, and for fisheries. We have conflict now between Bolivia and Chile for water. We have conflict now between Peru and Chile for fisheries. This conflict will be more serious in the future. And to finalize, to present some, you know, this table with the increase of temperatures in the worldwide, that means for the region a plus 2 to 4 degrees Celsius. In terms of water, the rain trends for Latin America, it's with the exception of Argentina, is less from 20% to 40% of the rainy regimes. This is Chile scenario. That means in all the territory in the next years to the year 2020 is from 2 to 4 in the worst scenario. You have reduction of glaciers in the area of central Chile and Argentina. You see the impacts on all the hotspots in America Latina, mainly because of water scarcity and biodiversity, loss of biodiversity. And you need to go to the question, and I want to finalize with this. We really need us a society to answer the question of survival and justice in a finite planet. And I think that, of course, we need negotiation. The team of the IG work a lot in discussion for negotiation for environmental sustainability and equity worldwide. But I think that what we learned in the last year is at the same time we need urgently more direct actions. And I think that negotiation is good. We can advance a little. But you see what's happened. And the last panel was very clear on what happened with the negotiation and how politics can be advanced a little. But if we don't have direct action with direct people in charge of this, is no change see in the future. Thank you very much.
That was Sarah Lorraine of Chile.
Dale Wen is our person representing the whole of China. Dale is a research fellow with the IFG and produced the report, The China Copes, a report on China Copes with Globalization, a mixed review. She came to the U.S. from China in 1993. She earned her PhD from the California Institute of Technology, and she's also had experience with rural communities in China and how they are impacted by globalization. She serves as an advisor for Rural China Education Foundation.
So I will tell you about basically the reality behind the so-called China's economic miracle and the ongoing debates going on right now in China. So this is a China we often see in the media, the rising China. And this is a China most of my university classmates are experiencing. Basically, we are happily on our way to middle-class lifestyle. But 7 years ago, when I started to do volunteer work for rural education in China, I discovered another China, the hinterland China. So this is a rural village, a village-level school. It was founded in the late 60s. Now the villagers have to beg donations from U.S. to renovate the school and keep it running. There are thousands of rural schools with similar history, and also already there are thousands of rural schools closed down due to lack of both capital and human resource support. So which China is more real, is more representative? In terms of numbers, we can say it's like despite of China's so-called economic miracle, the number of mass incidents, meaning protests, demonstrations, and even direct clashes with police involving more than 100 people is rising exponentially, much faster than the GDP numbers. So in 1993, there were 10,000 mass incidents, and in 2005, there are 87,000 mass incidents. So basically, the current Chinese government is really very busy being the firefighter. So why there are so many mass incidents? One is because we have huge growing inequality. Basically, the ratio between rural and urban income has grew hugely. So basically, in the early 80s, it's only 1.8 to 1. Now, it's more than 3.2 to 1. And the wealth is increasingly concentrated to a small elite. So in the early 80s, China was one of the most equal country, egalitarian country in the world. The top 10% of the population earns less than 20% of the income. But now in year currently, China actually is one of the most unequal country in the world. The top 10% get 45% of the wealth, while the bottom 10% of the population only got 1.4%, and it's still decreasing. When we talk about poverty, according to the criteria given by World Bank in terms of $1 per day in terms of purchasing power, in that measure, China has been a superstar in poverty alleviation. About 300 million people has been lifted out of poverty since year 78. But is this monetary measure of poverty accurate? I think I will provide lots of data for you to think about. But even in pure monetary terms, the Chinese government is acknowledging that the poverty is in danger of rising again. The number of rural people living in extreme poverty increased from 28 million in 2002 to 29 million in 2003. Also, between year 2000 and 2002, 40% of rural households experienced decreased income in absolute terms. Besides monetary measures, I will talk about also quality of life indicators like healthcare, education, and employment. So the Chinese healthcare system has gone through several rounds of neoliberal reform in the last two decades. The result, from 80 to 2003, the healthcare cost has skyrocketed 15-fold, and while the government or collective contribution has decreased significantly. In 78, more than 90% of Chinese were covered by government or collective healthcare. But currently, only about half of the urban population is covered by healthcare, while less than 10% of rural population is covered by healthcare. So the collapse of rural healthcare is nothing but heartbreaking. So the number of rural doctors has decreased from 1.5 million 30 years ago to 1 million today. And the number of rural nurses today is less than 10% compared to 30 years ago. And this is a 60-year-old barefoot doctor I just visited this summer. Because he's from this local village, so he has continued to serve the village for 30 years, despite his income from his medical practice is less than $40 per month, but he feels this responsibility. So he has to do farm on the side to support himself. But this village is really lucky to have him. But who will serve the village once he retires? So the consequence of the collapse of rural healthcare is really shows up in the life indicators. So between 49 to 78, China made huge progress in healthcare. The average life expectancy increased by 32 years, actually the fastest growth in the world. And despite of its huge population, China was the first developing country to eradicate smallpox and polio. Unfortunately, in the last 30 years, we had a wrong turn. Basically, since 1978, the average life expectancy only increased by 3 years, less than the world average. What's even worse, now there's a huge gap between urban and rural population. Basically, the urban population is living as long as the OECD country residents, while the average life expectancy of the rural residents is less than the national average 30 years ago. So in year 78, in WHO's conference, Health for All, in year 2000, China's primary health care was featured as model for the world. But when we actually come to year 2000, in a year 2000 World Health Report, China ranked 188 out of 192 countries in terms of fairness to access to healthcare, and 144 out of 191 countries in terms of overall performance. Instead of being a leader in the healthcare, now China has become the leader of the privatization of the healthcare. The same thing has happened to education. Education cost has skyrocketed in the last 20 years, while the share of government contribution has decreased, even for primary and secondary education. And currently, a four-year college education costs about 40,000 yuan, about 13 times of average per capita rural income. And in comparison, it was free when I went to college 15 years ago. That's why I say that the China's economic miracle is really partly built on the liquidation of human resources. Between 49 and 1980, the adult illiteracy rate decreased from more than 80% to 33%. But unfortunately, the trend has been reversed. Just this year, the Chinese government acknowledged that the number of adult illiterate population has increased from 87 million in 2000 to 116 million in 2005. The problem with education is not only the privatization, but also it's really the contents of the education, because in the last quarter century, education really has become a form of colonization. The most of the education material, as well as the media, carries the message that the only way to a better life is to industrialize, to urbanize, to copy the Western model. And everything urban is considered advanced and desirable. Everything rural is backwards and despicable. And even the peasant's traditional attachment to the land is being labeled as a stupid sentiment, should be replaced with upward mobility at all costs. The consequence of this such kind of education, it's an ideal preparation for sweatshops. So once one of my friends, an anthropologist, interviewed a female migrant worker in Shenzhen who survived a catastrophic factory fire that killed a few hundred of her fellow workers. So when my friend asked her, "Have you ever considered going back to the village?" She said, "Of course, no, because there's no possibility to be human back in the village." So with this kind of brainwash, people like her is willing to suffer the most horrendous sweatshop conditions in pursuit of the urban dream. Yes, if there's no possibility to be human back in a village, but it's not the natural consequence of economic development, but it's really the very visible hand of the government. While the government investment in agriculture and in rural infrastructure has decreased several fold in the last 2 decades, and the consequence, I will show you some pictures. So on the left is a highway financed by World Bank. And this guy standing there is standing on the exact plot of land his family used to farm. So that's what we are financing. But what we are not financing is a village road. It was built 30 years ago. That's a road villagers use every day. But we are financing the highways for the multinational corporations instead of rebuild the village road. And here on the left is a well-functioning irrigation canal in early 70s. And on the right, it's the exact same spot. The irrigation canal has been in total disrepair and dysfunctional. And because of that, the local peasants lost one third of their harvest every year due to drought or floods. So with this urban bias development model, the government is really investing for rural exodus. For example, for the year 2008 Olympics alone, the government is pouring more than 280 billion yuan into the capital city of Beijing. But in contrast, the annual government spending on rural healthcare is less than 3.5% of the Olympic expenditure. Of course, with such kind of bias, we see huge rural bankruptcy and desperate rural youth going to the cities looking for jobs. But is this new economy creating the jobs for them? While in the media, we often see China bashing, saying China is stealing jobs from the rest of the world. Yes, lots of manufacturing is relocating to China. But when we really look at the numbers, China is not stealing jobs from anybody. Actually, China is losing more jobs than any other country. From 1995 to 2000, manufacturer jobs decreased 15% from 98 million to 83 million. At the same time, globally, we lost manufacturer jobs in 20 million manufacturer jobs. So actually, China's manufacturer job loss accounted for two-thirds of the global shrinkage. So it's really this global restructuring is destroying jobs everywhere, including China. So with this kind of restructuring, which creates huge employment pressure, naturally, the labor conditions actually have deteriorated. So industrial accidents resulted in 40,000 severed fingers in Pearl River Delta per year alone. And who are most responsible for industrial accidents? It's a booming foreign-funded enterprises and domestic private enterprises. And the average salary of the China's middle class has been rising. It's estimated in Pearl River Delta, the management staff and technical staff, their income has been rising 5% per year for the last decades. However, for the average factory workers, it's a different story. Their income only increased by $8 nominally between 1992 to 2004. And in terms of real purchasing power, it has decreased by 30%. While the sweatshop conditions in many Chinese manufacturers has been increasingly exposed in West media, a big picture still not being shown because which are the families behind the Made in China label? So this is a family I visited this summer, and this is a very typical left behind family. So both of the parents have left to be migrant workers at the Yangtze River Delta because otherwise they cannot get the cash to pay medical bills or school fees. So they have left these three children to the care of this 75-year-old grandma. In China, there are 20 million left-behind children in rural areas who grow up without parents' presence. Talking about destroy of family values and destroy of communities, I really don't know anything bigger than this scale. While China is becoming the world factory, it's also becoming the world waste dump. So I will give you these numbers while showing you some pictures of the real pollutions in China.